Today's podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
All right, let's get it going right here, right now. This is Diamond Conversations, and you're listening to a brand new Diamond Conversations here exclusively on the Place to Be Nation podcasting network. If you didn't know by now, my name is Ian, and every single week, we sit down and have a diamond conversation with somebody related to the game of baseball, the world of baseball. And this week, oh, it's a biggie, ladies and gentlemen. Very happy and very honored to be joined by best-selling author, longtime baseball historian, the one and only, the great Peter Golenbach. Mr. Golenbach, thank you so much for coming on today.
Well, you're very kind. Thank you so much.
I have it with me. I don't know if you can see it, but I have my Bible with me.
Oh, I see it.
It's my copy of Amazing. This is an original copy. Always such a longtime fan of your books, going back to as a kid growing up. My uncle introduced me to the Bronx Zoo, which, yes, as a kid, did read the Bronx Zoo, but introduced to you at a young age. And I have to just upfront thank you for the many, many years of baseball love, baseball joy, and if anything, the education that I've gotten from reading your books.
Well, clearly you were one of those people who were fortunate enough to be born with the baseball gene.
Yes.
I've always said that those of us who were born with the baseball gene were always very special.
And it's something else, and it's a family thing. And, you know, and Doug in the middle here, he's the same way. You know, the books, he's to peel the curtain back, Doug is also my brother. The books got passed down, so it was from one generation to the next. And again, it's all about baseball, and that's why I do this show, and that's why we're so glad to have you on, because we're going to talk about Peter Golenbach today. I've read all the interviews, I've seen all the things that you do, and I'm always hearing about your subjects, but we're going to talk about you and learn more about your history today.
Oh, okay.
So basically, the first question would be, why baseball? Why the love of baseball? Like you said, it's the baseball gene. How did you get the baseball gene put in you, and how do you love the game of baseball as much as you do?
It's a very, very good question. I mean, I could only think, just, you know, it's hard to remember. The first baseball moment that I can remember was Willie Mays' catch in the 1954 World Series. I was born in 46, so I was 8 then. And that's really the first thing that I remember, which is kind of ironic in a way, because through my childhood, I grew up in Stamford, Connecticut, and my team was the New York Yankees. So I had the benefit every day of being able to watch Mickey Mantle, Yogi Berra, you know, later was Roger Maris, Tony Kubek, Bobby Richardson, Phil Rizzuto, Hank Bauer, Gene Woodling, all of these people of my youth. What happened was when I was 12 or 13 years old, I went into the library in Stamford, Connecticut, and I found a book called The New York Yankees, which was written by a reporter, a writer by the name of Frank Graham. And I started reading this thing, and it had conversations with Babe Ruth and conversations with Lou Gehrig. And I must have read that book, I don't know why, I don't know, 15, 20 times. I was just enthralled by it. It was part of why I ended up being a historian, so to speak. It was partly why I ended up being somebody who wanted to write baseball books, because after going to college and going to law school, I ended up at Prentice Hall, where I was writing a weekly report on President Nixon's wage and price controls. And just coincidentally, I happened to find a book of Prentice Hall's trade books, the books that they were publishing that particular year. And it included a book called A1, A2, you know, by the fella who my parents watched every Sunday night, Lawrence Welk. They had a book entitled Where the Money Is, which was written by a famous bank robber. And I thought to myself, well, maybe if I propose to them a sequel to The New York Yankees by Frank Graham, that they would give me a book contract. And so I walked into the office of a fellow by the name of Nick Dincheco. He was in charge of trade books at Prentice Hall at the time. And basically I told him what I wanted to do. And he was as big a New York Yankee fan as I was. And he gave me a contract. And that's what changed my life.
That's fantastic. It's all about chance. And it's all about, you know, you never know when that opportunity is going to strike. But it's amazing that a book like that is what kind of spawned your, you know, desire to explore the baseball books, because I can dare say, you know, like I'm saying, I'm holding this amazing book. I mean, that's just one of many of the, you know, New York centric baseball books that you've written. So going back to your love of the Yankees, was that something that was like a passed down team that you fell in love with? Or was there something about the Yankee teams of your youth that you were drawn to?
Well, I would say what drew me to the Yankee was the fact that they won pennants in 1955, 1956, 1957, 1958, 1960, 1961, 1962, 1963, and 1964. I dare to say if I were a Red Sox fan or a Washington Senators fan or a Philadelphia Phillies fan, I could not make a statement like that.
It's very true. Hey, we're a Brooklyn Dodger family, so you know we won some pennants, but we just never we only got the big one, you know, very sparingly. So that's
we could do an entire show on the Brooklyn Dodgers. Believe me.
Oh, I know it. And again, that's another one that's on the shelf. Bums, another book that again, it's like the Bible of baseball history for specific teams. But I mean, going back to the Yankees, so would we dare say it was Mickey Mantle that was your favorite player growing up?
Yeah, I wish I had my camera that worked here. I'd show you around my office all the various
I'd love to see that.
Mickey Mantle items that I have here.
What is it about the Mick?
He was God. Okay. What was it about the Mick? I don't know. You watched on TV and you were hoping that he would get up and hit a ball into the stands. Or he would make a spectacular play in the outfield, or he would throw somebody out at third, or he would bunt and beat out the ball, you know, beat out the throw at first base, or steal a base. I mean, there wasn't anything he could do.
It's unbelievable to look back, and you know, we hear comparisons to players today. People say maybe Mike Trout is this generation's Mickey Mantle. But you know, it's like he's the myth when you look back at some of the footage and to see all the things he can do.
Part of the problem with some of these players like Mike Trout, he plays in California.
Right.
You know, that's not the center of the media universe. New York is.
Right.
And, you know, as I said, he was also the star, he and Yogi and Whitey Ford, of that team that won 14 pennants in 16 years. That was Dynasty, my book Dynasty.
Right.
Was 14 pennants in 16 years, which unheard of.
No, it's unbelievable. You know, and the fact that there's just so much history with the Yankees that there is the opportunity to have so many different titles or so many different subjects to write about. When you started writing about the Yankee history, when you started delving into it as a writer, what were some of the things that kind of, you know, stood out to you that you did not know as a fan growing up?
Well, I was always more interested in what was going on behind the scenes than the scores of any games. So I wanted to know about the people. And when I started writing Dynasty, I was very lucky. So I went to see Marty Appel, who was the assistant PR guy at the Yankees. And I said to him, if I get a book contract, would you allow me to sit here in the stadium and go through all your hundreds and literally thousands of newspaper articles? And he said, of course. He says, but you'll never get a book contract, he said to me. But miraculously, I did. And so I came back to him and I said, I got a book contract. He said, hey, here's a chair and a table. Go to it. And I was there September, October, November, January, February, doing research that I was only going to use to write this book until, with all of these newspaper clippings, it occurred to me that there was nothing new here. Everything in the newspaper obviously was news. And if you wanted to write a book like Frank Graham's book, you wanted to write conversations. And the only way I could do that would be to go and interview these people. So I went to Michael Burke, who was the president of the Yankees at the time. CBS had bought the Yankees 1973. This was 1975. No, 72, 73. I went to Michael Burke of January 73, and I said to him, I'd really like to go and interview all these people. And he wrote me a letter. Dear Yankee, Peter Golombek is writing this fabulous book. We want you to give him your entire cooperation. And not only that, they gave me the addresses and telephone numbers of all of the former Yankees.
Wow.
And I went to see almost all of them. I got in my car or I got on a plane and I went to see them and talk to them.
So do you take a second to step back and look at the task in front of you, or you just kind of you keep it on the inside, the excitement, or, you know, the, you know, knowing what you got to do, but still you look how far you've come with just this one opportunity.
Well, it's funny. I always had sort of an arrogance about it. I always felt, you know, this is what I'm meant to do. And so I started, picking these players off one at a time and went to see them. Not knowing, for instance, that when I went to see Billy Martin, who was the manager of the Texas Rangers at the time, it was spring training and we sat and talked for about 2 hours. And when I wrote Dynasty, the thing that I said about Billy, one of the things I said was that he was as important to the Yankees for that period as Mickey Mantle or Whitey Ford was. And obviously nobody had ever said that about Billy. And so when it came time for Billy to write his book, he had his agent contact me.
Right.
And then when Billy couldn't do it at that moment, his agent said, I have one other client. His name is Sparky Lyle. Would you like to do a book with Sparky? So I said, well, I mean, he's a relief pitcher, and I understand he won the Cy Young Award last year, but why would anybody be interested in what Sparky has to say? And very wisely, knowing he gets 15% of whatever the book contract is, he said to me, well, go on down to Fort Lauderdale and meet with Sparky and talk to him. And I said, great. And I did that. I was living in Englewood, New Jersey, and I flew down to Florida, and I sat in the clubhouse with Sparky and with Reggie Jackson and with Thurman Munson and Greg Nettles and Ron Guidry and Billy Martin, and somewhere hovering above all of us was George Steinbrenner. And it occurred to me, you know, dummy, if Sparky would keep a diary, this might be something that might be very interesting. And what I didn't realize, what I didn't realize was that in the winter between 77 and 78, George Steinbrenner had bought Goose Gossage over to be the closer, to take Sparky's job. And not only that, he paid Goose $2 million and Sparky was making $140,000. So when we embarked on this book, I had no idea, A, that Sparky was a spectacular storyteller, or B, that he was really angry. And part of the wonder of the Bronx Zoo are all those stories he was willing to tell about George Steinbrenner.
And it really is. It is such a look into that team. So just so the listeners know, the Billy Martin book is called Number One. Again, required reading for Diamond Conversations. And then the Bronx Zoo. I mean, again, I feel like it changed the game in terms of how baseball books of even the modern era would still be written, because it peeled back so many layers and it gave you such an inside look of what the team was going through in that tumultuous time in those crazy years. Was that the intent, to peel back the curtain, let people look in the locker room, or did it just kind of develop like that as Sparky was keeping the diary?
No, that was my intent. Obviously, when you write a book, you want to write something that nobody knows. You don't want to write what everybody knows. You want to write what nobody knows. And it was what I wanted to know. And I always thought that if I'm doing a book with somebody, if they can tell me things I want to know, everybody else will want to know it also.
Right. Interesting. And actually, and the book itself is now an ebook. And again, it just gives you another outlet to get it. I mean, I remember the original, you know, cover that I had seen.
I think you can get it in paperback also.
You can, but it's just fascinating. You can get this in an ebook, and we'll talk about that aspect of.
I don't even know what an ebook is. I don't know. I don't know from ebooks.
Yeah, ebooks, it takes away from the physical holding of the book, and to me, the artwork of the original book is what I loved. And, you know, that to me, it's another layer. But talking about your style of doing the interviews, do you like interviewing the subjects and letting the story unfold? Or do you like having the story and then interviewing the subjects to kind of fill in the blanks?
Oh, no. When I go interview these people, I have absolutely no idea what they're going to tell me. I mean, the joy of doing the interview is having them tell you stuff. That's the fun of it. I mean, I don't know how better to explain that. I mean, I will arm myself with, you know, a couple of dozen questions because this is the minimum of what I want to know. But once you start talking with somebody and they tell you things that, you know, come from the deep, dark secret area, then you have, you know, 40 questions about, you know, what they're telling you right then. And the whole thing just sort of develops.
More conversational, because you don't know, you can't dictate how a conversation is going to go from the first sentence. So you kind of take it in and let it roll and just go with the instinct, actually, really, of the moment.
Of course. And the other thing you discover is you never interrupt somebody you're interviewing. They may be talking and you may have, you know, a particular question you want to ask them about what they're talking about. Hold on to that question until they're finished talking, because you just might cut off something really fabulous that they were about to say.
Without a doubt. Absolutely. One to grow on for sure. But then talking about how that book, so what did that book do for you in terms of other projects you were going to work on? Did it change any bit of where you would kind of look for other stories, or did it keep you kind of grounded still in the same direction of just wanting to write about sports, baseball more specifically?
You're talking about the Bronx Zoo?
Yes.
Well, the Bronx Zoo let me buy a 14-room house in Englewood, New Jersey, for one. and it also gave me a career that I was not intending.
Right.
After I wrote Dynasty, I went to work for the Bergen Record in Hackensack, New Jersey. I was listening in New Jersey. Always, I loved newspaper work. I was the something or other of the St. Luke's School Sentinel, editor of something, some kind. And at Dartmouth, I was the sports editor of the Daily Dartmouth. And that's the thing that I loved most about being in college, doing that. So when I went to work for the Bergen Record, I started covering four of the towns. And then I went to the copy desk, which I thought was fabulous, even though I worked from 10 o'clock at night to 6 o'clock in the morning. And then they hired me to be the assistant night news editor. And my intentions, eventually I would have been either one of the top editors at the Bergen Record or I was going to the New York Times, one or the other. That was my path until Doug Newton called to say that Billy Martin wanted to write this book with me. And that's what changed my life for the rest of my life.
Now, you've done other books outside of baseball. Where does that passion come from? Is it just wanting to try something different or expanding the horizon?
That comes from the need to pay your bills. That's where it comes from. Also, you know, I have a law degree. So when I was asked if I wanted to do a book with the lawyer for Casey Anthony, I thought, yes, I absolutely want to do that. And it turned out to be a fascinating adventure and a very, very interesting book. You know, I'm a political guy also. So I have a book out right now called American Nero, which is about, it's a history of the breaking of the rule of law in America and how this president has broken it more than anybody else.
So what's your approach for writing baseball outside of baseball books? Do you still kind of tackle it the same way, or do you have another way you go about building your stories?
Well, I mean, everyone is different. I mean, if I'm doing a book with Jose Baez and it's Jose Baez's story, I try to get, you know, as much information I can get from Jose Baez about what happened to him. If I'm doing a history of the breaking of the rule of law in America, which is what I did with Richard Painter, Richard wrote about Trump. And I spent my time researching the history of the rule of law in America. And we put the two together and made a very nice book that way. I mean, every book is different.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, one thing, this is just something that I noticed in kind of my research and also having a lot of these books. I love the fact that the titles are for the most part, they have that one word and they jump off the page at you. And a lot of the titles are one word. Is that purposeful or is that something that just the perfect name pops out and that's what's going to be in the book?
I believe the titles are extremely important to the success of any book. And I've always been sort of a title maven. I find that the title, you don't start with the title, you finish with the title. You figure out what's in the book and then you make the title around what's in the book. And that's what I've always done. So, for instance, I'm doing a book with Bobby Valentine right now. Valentine had a fabulous, fabulous career. He started out, he was going to be Mike Trout. And then when he was with California, he ran into the outfield fence and broke his leg into 17 different places. And after that, he ended up becoming a wonderfully controversial manager for years and years. Went to Japan, coached the Mets, as you know. So, you know, I'm struggling with the title right now. So I'm thinking I've got two titles. One title is I Manage. Now, that's got a lot of meanings. I Manage. That means despite all the adversity that this fella has had, he manages. It also means he's a manager. So there's that. And the other thing about him is that he's got a big mouth. And I thought perhaps the better title for this book would be Big Mouth. Okay. And who knows? Before I'm done, it may end up being something else. But right now, it's Big Mouth.
Big Mouth managing. You know, it's great. I mean, it's fascinating to look at them. You
it's
know,
got a sing. It's got to sing. It's all about the way the words sound to me. When I read things alive, they have to sing like poetry. If they don't sing, they're either in the wrong order or you're using the wrong word.
Yeah, like I said, pops off the cover, balls, bats, bums, you know, yeah. Driven, George. And to me, it's so poignant because that's the one word you got to grab the book. I mean, because it's not telling you, you know, the history of baseball in America, the story of blah, blah, blah. And now I'm sitting there going like, all right, well, I already have the idea of what this is. Whereas I see amazing. Well, I know that's the Mets catchphrase, but the story itself on the inside is what is the amazing part of it. So again, it works. That's what I could tell you.
Yeah, no, it's been rather remarkable. I've been able to do this since 1972. It's amazing. Amazing.
Amazing. I was going to say the perfect title for a Mets book, but talk about the New.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, let's talk about the New York centric books, because I mean, again, it's something that I gravitate to. So, you know, history with the Dodgers, history with the Yankees and then the Mets history. Do you find the New York teams have that deeper roots because of New York being such a traditional baseball town? I mean, I know obviously there is St. Louis books, there's Red Sox books, but it seems like New York with this history of four major teams that we could all rattle off at the top of our head, that there's endless material here almost, but these detailed histories, did you like exploring outside of just the Yankees?
Well, every team has its own history and every team has its own group of players. I mean, when I was writing about the St. Louis Cardinals and the St. Louis Browns, the Browns had a one-armed outfielder. His name was Pete Gray. And I interviewed three or four of the Browns players who played with Pete Gray, and they just enthralled me with their stories about how much everybody hated Pete Gray, hated having him on the team. They would torture him. They would put dead fish in the pockets of his jackets. You know, this was back in 1944, and they're telling me this story, and it's just fabulous. The thing about New York is that you've got, you know, 20 million people in the New York metropolitan area. That's a lot of book buyers. And the other thing you have in New York is you have the publishers. Almost all the publishers are in New York, and most of the editors are New York centric. So if you come to them with a book that's about New York, chances are they're going to buy the thing. And that's why so many New York books get published. I wrote a book called In the Country of Brooklyn. You know, if I had written In the Country of St. Louis, I never would have gotten it published. But In the Country of Brooklyn, that I was going to get published.
You know, I could tell you from family that lived in Brooklyn, you know, up until the early 90s. I mean, they're all scattered all over the country now. Nobody lives in Brooklyn anymore, but it all goes back. To Brooklyn. Yeah, it's all Brooklyn-centric still. Stories still revolve around Brooklyn. But it's also the love of baseball. And whether that's tied to the bums, the lovable losers. I always say, you know, we're Met fans, we're strong. But it seems like we inherited that from the Brooklyn Dodgers. And it's a never-ending thing. It never goes away. And that, to me, it's fantastic.
No. Those people who were children when the Brooklyn Dodgers abandoned them and went out to Los Angeles are sort of impaired for life. They will never get over that. They never have gotten over that. They never will get over that. It was as though their parents had died and left them as orphans.
I always say Gil Hodges, I always thought was like a distant relative because he was talked about with such, admiration and with such, just a revered personality in our family.
Absolutely.
I thought we were related to him somehow.
You were. Yeah, but that's the funny thing. You were related to Gil Hodges. That's absolutely right. And one of the mysteries to me is how Gil Hodges is not in the Hall of Fame when so many of his teammates are. Gil Hodges was as beloved, at least for those fans, as Mantle was. I mean, the Dodgers fans just loved Gil Hodges. And then, of course, as you know, he went to the Mets and won a world championship with the Mets, which made him even more beloved.
Yeah, mythical. And even coming back to the Mets in 1962 as an expansion team, you know, one of the clips they show of the original ticker tape parade of the Mets going down, you know, the Canyon of Heroes is Gil Hodges waving to the fans. And it's like, how could you not want to gravitate to this team if you were a Dodger fan? Because here's your guy. And then Duke Snider follows. It's a great history, and it's a bridge that is perfectly crossed, a Brooklyn bridge, perhaps, from those Dodger fans to the Met fans.
Well, and the genius of it, of course, the genius of it is that they hired Casey Stengel to manage these guys. You know, all the players on the Mets in 62 were pretty much either over the hill or they weren't good enough to make some other team. So it was not a very good team. What did they win? 40 games, and they lost 120, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the worst teams in the history of baseball, but nobody cared. I went to a bunch of those games at the Polo Grounds to watch those guys play. I mean, I rooted for them all.
I was going to say we could have used young Peter Golenbach to come over at that point, leave all those pennants behind and start fresh with a brand new team. Now, before we head to the wrap, just again about you growing up. Now, one of the books that pops off the page, more recent book that you wrote was Rage, about Bill Dennehy, who's the other guy on Tom Seaver's 1967 rookie card. Now, did you collect baseball cards growing up? Because, I mean, it was such a big part of Americana. Did you kind of learn some of your baseball history through the cards?
Of course. Of course I did. Sure. I had a complete collection of the 54 tops through the 60 tops.
Wow.
I had them. Yeah.
Any favorites? Any favorites that pop out? I'm sure it's the Mick, but any other favorites?
Well, I think the 56 tops. The horizontal cards. I think Mickey was number 200, I think. I have a painting here in my office, which I'm sorry that I'd show you if my camera worked. It's of the Mickey Mantle card of the Bowman of 1954, where Mantle is swinging a bat. And I had somebody paint a painting of that card, and it's sitting on my wall. I also have a painting by another artist of Mickey Mantle, Roger Maris. And the original painting had Tom Tresh as the left fielder, but he took away Tom Tresh's face and put my face in the picture. So in this painting is Mickey Mantle, Roger Maris, and me.
That's great. What a keepsake. You can't you can't find any other mementos better than that to put you right there with the M&M boys. So
that's exactly all right.
Well, as we head into the wrap, I would love to have you back at some point because there's so much more that we want to talk about. And I know Doug, who had to drop off, unfortunately, had a few questions for you. So I'd love to have you come back because just scratching the surface, if you will. But like I'm very happy to hear about the Bobby Valentine book. That sounds fantastic. But if you can share with the listeners, you know, kind of what you've been up to lately, any other books that you've had come out and, you know, where they can find more information about where to get them and anything else you've got going on.
Well, my latest book is American Nero by Ben Bella Press. And certainly you can go to Amazon and get a copy. If you care about democracy, if you care about what's going to happen to this country, this book will tell you the problems that we're having right now with the current president. I did it with Richard Painter. You may know him from MSNBC and CNN. He was the ethicist at one time for George W. Bush. He is somebody who is terribly afraid for what's going to happen to this country, as I am. And so we wrote what we consider to be a really interesting book about what happened when various presidents broke the rule of law and what's happening now when this president is doing it. And that's what that book is all about.
Fantastic. Yeah, that's very good. And again, it's great to see that, you know, people, if you want to expand your horizons, there's a lot by your favorite author out there. And also on Twitter, you're at Peter Golenbach, very easy enough to remember. And, you know, I can't express to you enough how happy I am that you took the time to join us. Again, it's a long time coming, reading these books, going back to being a young guy and getting my baseball education through them. And that's no joke. That's no exaggeration.
You can't see me because my camera's not working for some reason, but I am smiling broadly. And I thank you very, very much.
Well, I can't thank you. So appreciate that. And again, this was Diamond Conversations. If you want to follow me on Twitter, it's at Chad Ian B. And this is a great one. And Mr. Golenbach, again, it's a pleasure. And you are more than welcome to come back. And we would love to have you. So I'm going to hold you to the fire on the air before I stop recording for that.
Anytime.
Oh, fantastic. All right, folks. Well, this is enough out of me. I will catch you next week on the flip side.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. The Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed. We dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth search projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture.